From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
If you had told me I'd be reading an entire book about okra, and often laughing out loud delightedly in the process, I'd have said, no way. But here I've been lately, my nose in Chris Smith's just published The Whole Okra, a seed-to-stem celebration, gaining an entirely new perspective on this much maligned but resilient vegetable that Smith predicts will be important for future food security in a changing climate. More in a moment, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
British-born Chris Smith's day job is as communications manager for So True Seed in Asheville, North Carolina. Before and after hours, you'll often find him growing or maybe cooking and certainly eating okra, lots and lots of okra, or directing the Utopian Seed Project and serving on boards of other nonprofits focused on seed and food security and sustainability. It's so great to speak to you again, Chris. How are you?
I'm great, Margaret. Thank you. And yeah. I just want to start by saying you're surprised that you were reading a book on okra. I was pretty surprised to find myself having written a book on okra.
I know. And part of the reason being, you're from Southport, England, yes?
Southport, England, yeah, where very, very little okra is grown or eaten.
And guess where my family's from?
Don't say Southport, North Carolina.
Okay, I won't say, no, Southport, England. My family is from there. So there you go, Chris, small world. I kid you not.
Yeah. We'll have to talk about that more another time.
Okay, but isn't that weird?
Very weird. It makes it even more weird because there are so many Americans that I have met that have connections to Southport, England.
Yes, yes, yes. So I guess I should have said in the little bio in the introduction that you are also the guy at seed conferences who walks around carrying a sign that says, I want to talk to you about okra. How'd you turn into that guy, from a guy from Southport, England, to that guy?
I guess it was through a pretty rapidly developed fascination with a vegetable that I thought was awesome and brilliant after I got to know it. And so many people I came across, especially with that sign, did not agree with me.
It's funny. And do you remember your first okra?
I do. That one I remember well. That was not my best experience. And this is something I've found a lot when I've spoken to people about okra, is they have a bad first experience with it. And when
yes.
you have a bad experience with okra, it can really be quite bad. So they never give it a second go. Luckily, I gave it a second go, but my first experience was kind of a greasy spoon just outside of Clayton, Georgia.
Yeah.
And it was deep fried, probably frozen okra,
yeah.
old oil. It was just, it was all the stereotypes that okra is not, you know, well loved for.
Yeah.
And I had that bad experience, but I did come back around to okra later in my life and really developed a fascination with it.
Well, you know, when I worked for Martha Stewart for her magazines and so forth, we did what we called glossary stories. Like, we'd grow every kind of basil we could find and compare and photograph them all and write a story about basil, a glossary of basil, or 40 different winter squashes or dozens of different tulips or whatever. You grew a lot of okra for the research of this book. So tell us how crazy you got.
Yeah, we got pretty crazy. Last year, I grew 76 different varieties of okra split across three different trials.
Mm-hmm.
And then this year, I have an entirely different set of okras, and I have 50 different okras in the ground. So it's about 125 total that I'm currently experiencing and experimenting with.
Out of how many do you suspect there are out there named okras?
Well, named okras, it's hard to tell, but the USDA keeps a kind of a gene bank of various accessions,
uh-huh.
and they have over 1,000 different okras in their gene bank. And then India has over 4,000 in their gene banks.
Wow.
And that's just like two of the larger world gene banks of okra. So there's certainly a huge amount of varietal diversity out there.
Right. So I was thinking a book about okra would be academic and dry, and absolutely this is not. Your book is not your a charming and extremely talented writer. So, you know, I wasn't surprised to read in your bio that you have a master's in creative writing from the University of Manchester and have published various short stories and so forth, because it comes through the way you tackled this subject that could have been academic, you know, it could have been a research paper kind of a thing. And the device you used in the book of creating conversations between you and Okra, as the two characters, passages of dialogue between you and this poor, low self-esteem creature back and forth, trying to help it develop a better self-image. I mean, besides laughing, as I said in the intro, I was just so touched by that device, you know. So let's trace a bit of Okra's roots. Where does it come from, and taxonomically, who's it related to, this poor low self-esteem? And what's its scientific name, I guess, first off?
Yeah, so first off, it's in the Malvaceae family, or the mallow family, and a lot of plants in that family are known for their mucilaginous qualities, and actually some of those plants are celebrated, you know, things like some of the common mallows are used, even the marshmallow, right? The marshmallow is celebrated for some of its slimier qualities. But then Okra is Ablemosius esculentus, mm-hmm. and within the genus Ablemosius, it's disputed, but, you know, somewhere between 8 and 12 species, of which one is Okra. So it has a few relatives out there, and the diversity within that genus, it can be traced to have these two centers. One is in Eastern Africa and one is in India. Mm-hmm. And that kind of gives rise to a little bit of dispute about, like, where its true origins are.
Right.
I kind of came to the conclusion it probably had ancestry going back to India, but it was more than likely domesticated in the Ethiopian region, mm-hmm. in East Africa. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of like, but both of them have pretty valid claims, but it seems that most of the earlier cultivation and certainly some of the terminology around it and the earlier written record dates it back to coming from Ethiopia in domestication.
Mm-hmm. And its cousins, besides these other mallows that we might be familiar with, what are some of its other cousins? Because some of them are pretty unexpected and not as much maligned as Okra.
Yeah, we're talking about cousins within the family or cousins within the genus?
Within the family, I think they were. Like, isn't cotton a relative?
Okay, I'm with you. Yeah. So I kind of opened the book with a fairly jovial family reunion, and it's a Malvaceae family reunion.
Yes.
Reunion. And so some of the family members would be, one would be like the most maligned vegetable out there probably, or fruit, is durian fruit, which is a pretty funny one. I don't know if you've ever experienced it in kind of Southeast Asia, but when I was in Thailand one time, they actually have these warning signs on public transport saying no durian fruit. It's like no weapons, no cursing, no nudity, and no durian fruit.
It's that bad, folks.
it's got this very malodorous type smell to it that is pretty offensive. So that's one of its cousins, uh-huh. which Okra is not as maligned as. But then pretty much everything else, things like cacao, cotton, if you've seen it growing, then the flower is very hibiscus-esque. So all the hibiscus plants like the sabdifera, the roselle, and the red zinga, as well as the common ornamental hibiscus plants. What else is in there? Oh, a lot of fiber plants, things like kanaf and kapok are in them that have all been fairly well researched for fiber production and paper production from those fibers.
So cacao, like cocoa? Like
yeah,
chocolate?
Yeah, the chocolate, effectively, cacao is
so that was at the family reunion.
They came to the family reunion, and obviously that one's a famous one, mm-hmm. that is loved by everyone. So that's one that Okra would probably hide from if they came to, it would be very shy in its presence.
So you really work in the book, and it's not all the dialogue, but you've used it really well to keep the book moving and just make it a great read. While telling us the history and the taxonomy and so much more about the diversity and so forth, you work to convince Okra that it has value, and in fact that it's a superfood, which science tells us it is. So tell us about that, the nutritional value of Okra.
Yeah, there's two aspects to that kind of like superfood element. One is its nutrition is pretty outstanding. You know, it's very low calories, but it's got good levels of vitamins A, C, and K, and then it's got some of the bigger minerals, like it's good in calcium, potassium, magnesium, and then it's got a whole bunch of micronutrients. Mm. But then it's also got a good amount of soluble and insoluble fibers, so good for the digestion, good for people use it for diabetes to lower the blood sugar level. Uh-huh. And then the mucilage, that the slime that nobody likes, that in itself is very healing. And we know that if we stop and think about it, because, you know, we eat flaxseed and chia seed and aloe, all these products are good for our internal gut health because they've got that slimy quality to them.
Yes.
And okra has that same stuff. So,
it's really
healthy to eat.
Is the mucilage the former, or maybe it still exists, the paste, the glue, kind of a brown glue that I remember in my childhood that we used for, you know, doing collaging and stuff like that. Does it come from one of these plants, mucilage, a glue?
I really don't know. It wouldn't surprise me if it was a plant derivative.
Yeah, but it's funny. Because the same word, you used to just use the word, and I thought, oh, I wonder if it, anyway, there was a glue, and it came in a rubber topped bottle, you know, and I wonder. I'm going to look that up. But so yeah. You're also,
that was called mucilage.
Yes, mucilage. Oh. Yeah, and it was, you know,
I don't
everyone
think we heard about that in Southport, England.
No, and everyone had even before sort of Elmer's glue, the white, you know, liquid glue in a plastic bottle and so forth. Anyway, so a fun fact to look up, but who knows? But you're especially drawn to okra because of your commitment to, you know, you work, as I said, at So True Seed, and you do all this other nonprofit, you know, on the board, and you founded an organization. You're concerned about plants that will be here with us as the climate changes. So this is a resilient plant, isn't it?
Yeah, it's super resilient, and it's really good for feeding a lot of people, which I think we'll get to. But in terms of its resilience as just a plant to grow, then for starters, it's got an incredible root network. So it's got a real deep taproot, and it's got a really good lateral thick branching network there. So it can mine for its own nutrients. It doesn't need heavy fertilizer use or anything like that, and it can mine for water. So it's very drought resistance. And then after you find that these plants that do have the mucilage within its plant cell structure, that's also a kind of a drought tolerant characteristic. So we find that it can perform very well in drought conditions and still produce. And then in heavy rain conditions, which is actually what we had for most of my trials last year, like there was massive
Yes.
crop failings across North Carolina and other parts of the country last year because of all the heavy rains and hurricanes. And okra actually thrives in those hot, wet conditions. It's more productive with the rain, even though it's also drought tolerant. So it can ride both extremes, which is what we're beginning to experience, these longer periods of intense weather systems that hang around and really upset agriculture. Okra is able to weather those storms, as it were.
Besides its slimy reputation, okra in its sort of original, probably species version, is also spiny, and that can be a mouthful. if you bite onto the wrong one that's raw, it can be very unpleasant, yes?
Very, very much so. That's, you know, it was funny. I carry around that sign at all these conferences I go to, and it seemed to be an open invitation for people to come and complain to me about okra.
Yes.
So one of the chief complaints from people that are growing okra is that it's got all these trichomes on the leaves, sometimes the pods, sometimes the stem. Actually, even sometimes the calyx of the flower can have that irritating spines, and that's no fun to pick. It's actually quite miserable. I did a little experiment where I harvested my whole field without any protective clothing, like gloves or long sleeves, just to if I'm going to write about something, I want to experience it in depth. And it nearly drove me mad. Like, literally, I felt like a rabid badger as I drove home to try and wash off these spines that were just, insatiable itch. It was terrible.
That's funny. Rabid badger. Now that's coming from your roots as well. Yeah, badger, huh?
I guess there's not many badgers out here.
No.
Huh? Very cool animal, though.
It is. So I think it was maybe around in the middle of the 20th century. I can't remember the date exactly, but a big revolution in okra was when someone said, hey, here's the first spineless variety. Yes? Was that Clemson?
Yes. That's Clemson spineless. And lots of people were looking to develop a pod that was not spiny. Mm-hmm. And actually, before Clemson spineless was released, and that was in 1939, Clemson spineless was officially released, although the spineless development of that variety started 40 years before that in the late 1800s. But yeah, it was a really like an awesome example of how as a home seed saver that appreciates certain traits within a crop, we can really direct and change the way those plants perform just by selectively from the plants that perform the best. And this guy was specifically selecting for spinelessness, and he did that for 40 years before Clemson University picked it up and turned it into a saleable variety. But at the same time as he began his selections for spinelessness, another seed company, I think this was released in the 1890s, released a variety called White Velvet. Oh. So we see two pods. We have ones that are like totally smooth, so there's no spines, and that was one track. And then the other track, we saw the velvets, and the velvets still have spines, but they're soft and downy and non-irritating.
I see. Okay. Huh. Interesting. What's the sort of range of pod size, shape, color? You said you grew, 70 or something? What's the diversity when they come to harvest and you have all of this these pods?
It was actually a small concern of mine was, okay, I'm going to grow all these different varieties. Are they really just fairly close iterations of Clemson spineless or red burgundy? But when you walked into my field, I had six plants of every variety. And it was just astounding, not just pod differences, but the plants, the leaves, the stem color. It was really fun to walk down the rows and just see dramatic differences. But in the pods specifically, we saw like all sorts of different combinations. But basically on color, you're going from like the palest, it's really, really pale green, almost white, through to the just deep, beautiful, dark, almost purplish reds. And then you have mixes of reds and greens in some pods. So you get some variation there. But then in shape, you get these long ones that curl like cow horns. You get wiggly ones that don't actually curl all the way around. You get fat ones and thin ones. And then you have these ridges in okra where the seeds form. And some of them are totally round. You can't identify any ridges on the outside. And some of them are deeply ridged. And when you cut through them, they look like these beautiful star shapes. And then, fat and short, long and thin, and then I had ones that I called the big stubby was the smaller ones that were fat. And then I called elongated was the long ones. Yeah. And then I had kind of ones in between that were just like big pods. There's a variety called Louisiana 16 inch long pod.
Wow.
And I measured it at maturity. It was 16 inches. I couldn't believe it.
True to its name.
True to its name.
Huh.
Lots of fun.
Did you start them from seed? And if so, did you start them at the same time as a certain crop that we might be more familiar with? Like, do you sow them at tomato sowing time? Or what did you do?
Yeah. I feel like they're relatively similar to tomatoes in cultivation in that tomatoes like the heat. But we have to start them early to get them transplanted to grow in our season. And so tomatoes are grown all the way through the U.S., but okra is always thought of as this southern crop because it needs all that heat to grow. But it's actually very quick to maturity. It's 55 to 60 days to maturity from that seed germinating. So if you're further north, you can just start it indoors like you would a tomato, probably not as early as a tomato because it germinates and grows so rapidly, but just give it 2 to 4 weeks ahead of that last frost.
Yes.
And then you can transplant it out. And if you transplant okra, then you get much quicker production and growth. and you could definitely grow it in a fairly short northern season as long as you had relatively hot daytime highs.
So but part of the beauty of the book and the adventure in the book is that you also give a lot of ways for eating okra. And in the last few minutes, I wanted to kind of talk about the range. I mean, there are everything from, from some of my farmer neighbors grow it, and they grow spineless types, and we just eat it like crudité. I mean, we, you know, just crunch on the pods fresh, like you would a green bean out of the garden or whatever. It's just, they're delicious, I think. At least I'm one of the people who doesn't hate it. But you have lots of different ways of eating. Can you tell me a little bit about some favorite ways like that you're using it in the kitchen?
Definitely. I do love eating it raw. I think that's the best way to kind of evaluate all the subtle flavor nuances. So that's super exciting. We cut it into salads and that kind of thing. One of my favorite recipes is this recipe from a local chef here in Asheville, Steve Goff, and he made an okra pod kimchi, and it was so awesome because he took these red pods and rolled them in coarse salt to just kind of puncture the outside and start them sweating out the moisture, and then had this delicious spicy chi paste. And when it all fermented together, you got the sour, spicy, crunchy okra. It was phenomenal. And red pods are like red beans in that they will leach their colors when you cook them, but kimchi is raw, so the red pods keep their color in the red chi paste, and it's just a
beautiful, literally tasty.
It's such a great dish. So that's pretty fun. Obviously, pickled okra. I have a recipe for pickled okra that's just incredible, and the secret ingredient is turmeric. It really makes them pop. And then I guess if I've got time, just to throw in some of the crazier stuff. The seeds are edible and high protein, so we roast the seeds and grind them to make a flour. So I had a local baker, Owl Bakery, made an okra seed sourdough, which is like nutty and delicious and vegetal. There's an okra seed savory muffin, okra seed pancakes. There's all sorts of things you can do with this flour that is gluten-free and rich in flavors. So it's a really fun flour to work with. So yeah, I enjoy working with the seeds. It's lots of fun. You can press them for an edible oil. There's a guy called Clay Oliver who is selling okra seed oil out of Georgia, and it's just a really well-bodied olive oil-esque oil. So like an olive oil of the South is what we like to call it.
Now, did I make this up, or is there sort of like using the raw seeds as like almost like a caviarish texture dish? Is there like a spread or something that people make out of the seeds?
Yeah, you can. So when the pod is just overgrown, so it's kind of beginning to become fibrous, but it's still green, then the seeds inside are immature at that stage, but fully formed.
Right.
And you can kind of shell them like a bean or a pea or, you know, a cowpea or something, and use that for various preparations. A chef out of Charlotte called Clark Barlow, he makes like an Israeli couscous dish with lemon balm and goat's cheese and that kind of thing. And it's really quite tasty.
And is it true that you had okra as the topper of your Christmas tree? Besides walking around at conferences with a sign about okra.
Yeah, I kind of went all in on the okra, and my I have two young daughters, and so we get all these dried pods, and we're trying to be creative with ways we could use them. So they make great fire starters. I've inoculated them with oyster mycelium to grow mushrooms on the spent dried pods. And then my daughters and I, you know, we had an art day. We painted them, and we made a Christmas star. They're really quite beautiful. I think there could be a market there for the flower arrangement type business.
Oh yes,
they've got so many subtle tones of browns and creams and these beautifully shaped elegant pods, but we just hung them on our Christmas tree and painted them, and it was a pretty fun activity.
So in the last literal 1 minute, favorite varieties that we should be on the lookout for, and where should we look to if we want to try growing it next year?
So I would throw out the Bradford family okra. If you're a Clemson spineless lover, but you want this is like super Clemson spineless. So it's pretty similar in shape, but it tastes better.
Okay.
It grows longer and all that sort of stuff. So that's an improved Clemson spineless in my opinion. Aunt Hetty's Red won our taste test of the red varieties.
Mm-hmm.
And so both those varieties are available from So True Seed for sure, and probably other seed companies.
Okay.
But then the variety that won the taste test was a Turkish variety called Yalova Akoy, which is the name of the province from Turkey where it came from. And it beat out, we did a 60 variety taste test, and it beat out every other variety. 15 judges all agreed it was the best okra.
That was some party you had, an okra party.
Yeah, it was a good day. So that one's was introduced by Two Seeds in a Pod, which is mm-hmm. a small seed mm-hmm. company specializing in Turkish varieties. He sold out of that this year, and So True Seed is growing it this year. So year, both companies should be carrying that variety. It's a great variety.
Good. Well, Chris Smith, the book is The Whole Okra, A Seed to Stem Celebration, and we'll have a book giveaway with the transcript on awaytogarden.com. Thank you so much for making the time and for a really beautifully written book. A lot of fun and a lot of information.
My pleasure. Lots of fun.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes or Spotify. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and Instagram as @awaytogarden, and happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.